Well, good morning, everybody. My story begins when I was a teenager. I was 15 at the time, when an event happened in my life that was to change my whole life and turn it upside down. It was, of course, the famous siege of the city. It shouldn't have come as a surprise because the army that attacked us had already won amazing victories over strong countries to the north and the south of us. But they quickly surrounded and overpowered the city of peace, and we were forced to surrender. Personally, I was very nervous at that point. I thought, well, there's a good chance I'll be killed. My mother tried to comfort me and encourage me. She used to sing. She sang a song of King David, and it went something like this: though an army besiege me, I will not be afraid. Though an army come against me, even then will I be confident. It sounded better when it was sung, to be honest. My dad was more of a pessimist. He said, well, look, we've had this coming to us. We've known for a long time. We've heard from wiser people than I that we're due for a major defeat coming up here because of our disobedience to God. So the terms of surrender were very quickly agreed and came as quite a surprise to everybody. The conquering commander demanded that a certain amount of gold and silver from the temple treasury be handed over to him. This was perhaps an obvious thing looking back. Our previous king Hezekiah had rather foolishly taken it upon himself to show the enemy round about the temple treasury to indicate how much gold and silver we had. So obviously, here they were back again saying, yes, we'd like to have it now. The other part of the surrender terms was that the young men of the royal family and of the noble families were to be taken away into exile back to the capital city of the enemy. The problem for me was that I was going to be one of those hostages. And as long as the king of our own country behaved himself and the people didn't revolt, then we would be safe. If not, then we'd had it. The commander of this enemy army was only 8 years older than me, 23. He was the crown prince at that time, and in 2 years' time, he was going to take the throne of his father, Nabopolassar, become king, and not only king, but emperor of one of the greatest kingdoms in the world. But I must apologize now because I haven't actually introduced myself. My name, of course, means the Lord helps. The Lord helps. And that was the story of my life from then on. That whenever I was in danger, whenever I was fearful, I experienced the Lord's help. I had another name, of course, an Akkadian one. It was Servant of Nabu. I preferred the first name. Although outwardly I might have appeared quite confident and quite fearless, inwardly I was anything but. I was the timid one of the group of three of us, and whenever people spoke of us little group of three friends, I was always the one that was named last. Well, we hostages were taken 500 miles east to the great land between the rivers, the Euphrates and the Tigris, and there we entered into the biggest and grandest city in all the world. Famous for its architecture, famous for its city walls, which were so wide that it was said that a four-horse chariot could turn round on top of the walls. And very famous, of course, for mathematics. And that was where, a couple of thousand years before my time, things like the abacus had been invented, despite what other nations claim, and trigonometry, and other aspects, including Pythagoras' theorem, as it came to be known, were discovered in that famous city. Well, We and my friends and I were all examined for our physical health, and they were put through a certain number of tests to see how intellectually capable we were. And we were then enrolled in a 3-year degree course in which we had to study many strange subjects. I did already, of course, speak and read Hebrew. I could already speak Aramaic, which fortunately most people in the city spoke. But being selected to work in the royal palace, I had to learn Akkadian, the ancient language of the region, and I had to learn to write, and, or rather to inscribe and to read cuneiform, which was rather more tricky. I learned philosophy. I learned so much literature. I learned about astronomy. I learned about astrology. There was even a course on how to interpret dreams. This was something I was never really into, never really got it. But our good friend, Daniel, he loved it. He excelled in it. And Daniel, who I must tell you more about, was somebody, he was one of us, but he was that bit above us. Somebody you would look up to and admire. Someone who somehow seemed closer to God than the rest of us. He would say to us, "Friends, you have to be pure. You have to listen to your conscience." He said, "Do you realize the food these people are giving to us that the king eats has already been offered to idols, the local gods? We shouldn't be eating it because our allegiance is to the great God of heaven." I didn't really get that too. I thought, what harm will it do to eat a little bit now and again? But we got vegetables day after day. I got used to them. I had a lot of insecurities in those days, leaving your home and your family. We didn't know if we would ever see them again. There was a fear in me of failing to succeed, of not being good enough, failing to impress, perhaps being found out to be a fake and not as good as people thought I was. And there was that fear of living in a strange country and a people who had a different language, different cultures. But gradually over the years, I began to see that they were people just like me, that we were all humans, that we were all fellow travelers traveling through this world, and we had so much in common. Out of the four of us, my two friends, myself and Daniel, Daniel somehow appeared completely fearless. Now, he couldn't have been completely fearless, but I think he feared less. He feared less. It wasn't that he was brave, because bravery, in a way, was something he didn't need to have. Bravery was something that people who lack confidence and are fearful do need to face up to things they're afraid of. But Daniel's name means God is my judge. And I think in that is his secret. God was someone that Daniel did fear. He feared God, and therefore he feared nobody and nothing. And he said, if only we realized that, we too could learn that secret. But there was one time when I saw Daniel really frightened. He was speaking to the king, and he had something to say to the king that was very bad news to be passing on. Daniel wasn't so much terrified of the king. He was terrified of his thoughts and the impact that would have on the king. He had to give him some really bad news. There was another time Daniel told us of being frightened, and that was when he was on his own praying, and he had a vision. A vision, he said, of someone like a man. And Daniel had spoken to this figure, and he said, Daniel had said, "How can I, your servant, talk with you, my lord?" And the hand of the figure touched Daniel and said, "Daniel, you are highly esteemed. Stand up and do not be afraid. O man, highly esteemed, be strong now. Peace, be strong." Daniel told me about another vision he had when an angel spoke to him. And the angel, he said this to him, "Daniel, O man greatly beloved." Twice he called him greatly beloved. No wonder Daniel was fearless. He had this sense that God was to be respected, and yet God was the one who loved him, and he was the beloved, the dearly beloved of God. He had such confidence that he could go to the king, who had the power of life and death over all of us, and say to him, "Your Majesty, you're wrong. You're sinning. You must stop sinning." He could say, "You're not humble enough, Your Majesty." And he could do that because he was a man of integrity. If you always tell the truth, you're never going to be afraid of being found out. If you always obey your conscience, you're never going to be ashamed. Now, unlike Daniel, the courtiers of the palace were absolutely terrified of the king. Ashpenaz, for example, thought he might lose his head. He required unquestioning obedience. But you know, the king himself was afraid. "I have seen him, despite his outward bravado, I have seen him reduced to a wreck after a dream, and having heard Daniel explain the dream to him." And he was right to be afraid, because we knew from the visions and the dreams that very, very hard times awaited the king. As I lived in the city, prayer became a bigger and bigger part of my life. It happened, I suppose, because I was learning from Daniel. Daniel believed in a regular, disciplined time of prayer, 3 times a day. He went to the same place, to the window of our house, the window facing roughly toward our home city. He knelt down. He prayed at these times, 3 times a day. An event occurred at that time that taught me how important it was to pray. The king had lost his temper with all the magi, all the wise men of the court. And Daniel came rushing home one day to say, "Look, we have to pray. We have to pray together earnestly, because the king has said, unless his dream can be revealed," not only what the dream meant in this case, but what the dream had been. The king had forgotten the dream. He, Daniel, was going to be killed, and all the other magi and diviners of dreams. So we prayed and we prayed and we pleaded with God as if, well, Daniel's life did depend on it. And that very night, God revealed in a dream what the king's dream had been. So lest we ever doubt that God hears prayers, he does. There is a God in heaven. Daniel went through other bad times. There was a time when for 3 weeks he was mourning. He couldn't eat anything. He was pleading with God. He was crying. He felt hopeless and depressed. And at that time, he had a vision at the end of those 3 weeks. He said to us, the vision was like somebody, like a man came to me. A man dressed in linen, with a fine belt of the best gold around him. His body was chrysolite. I don't know what chrysolite is, to be honest. His face was like lightning. His eyes were like burning torches. His arms and legs were like gleaming burnished bronze. And moreover, his voice was like the voice of a multitude. And the voice said to Daniel, who was so depressed and so down, "Daniel, do not be afraid. Since the very first day that you set your mind to gain understanding and to humble yourself before your God, your words have been heard, and I have come in response to them. The truly humble man, I believe, he always hears." Now, living abroad in a foreign country can be difficult, but there were three things that helped. First was word that came from the famous prophet Jeremiah, and he had advice for us, which was very helpful. He said, "Seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf." And this gave us that sense of why we were there, for a purpose, to become a blessing to the people of that enormous city. Secondly, I was with very good friends. We met together, we prayed together, we ate together. We were like family. I remember a time when Daniel was promoted to a very high position. His very first request to the king was for us. My three friends are worthy too of promotion, and indeed we were elevated to greater responsibility. It was a case of looking out for each other, one all for one and one for all. And the third thing that helped, I think, was the principle of acceptance. To accept that this was now my home. This was where I would be in all likelihood for the rest of my life. This was where I would put down my roots. I would not fight against it, wishing I was back home. But this had become my home with all its customs. Customs that seemed strange, but were not bad. They were just different, to realize that. But to hang on to that one thing, to my devotion, my service to God. Now, you may point out that we had a lot of advantages over the man in the street. We had had a private education, came from very high up in the social order. We were very handsome, so I'm told, in those days anyway. Our physical prowess was beyond question. We were high achievers, straight A's, all our exams. We were the envy of many people, and in some ways I feel we were envied by the king, despite all that he had. But the king was plagued by a kind of insecurity in him. He had ambitious building programs, building canals to irrigate the land, building temples to various gods, building ziggurats, a kind of pyramid kind of thing, statues, bridges, all sorts of things. But the more he built, the more chance there were that they would collapse or be attacked. And he went on military adventures. He went back to our home city, attacked it a couple more times, brought many, many more people as exiles to the land between the rivers. But again, the more territory he had, the more he could lose. If, like me, you had nothing, then you had no reason to fear losing it. If you have an empire, you worry about it being taken away. But if you have your security from God, if you're part of his empire, you don't need to build your own empire to feel you're in charge. You're content because he is in charge. There were many dangers for us, of course. There were some things that mitigated the danger, and again, Daniel showed us the way. He was a man of incredible politeness, tact, and courtesy. The way he spoke to Ashpenaz, the way he spoke to Arioch, the commander of the army, was always done with great discretion. He showed respect, and he gained respect. But always, at the back of whatever we did, we put God first. And that, of course, was what led to me being sentenced to death. The king had, I don't know what was going through his head. He'd had a dream about a statue of gold. It had feet of clay and was going to collapse. But he got this idea to build a statue. He had acquired vast amounts of gold, so he thought, get a gold statue. dedicate it to my local gods, you know, Nebu and Marduk, Ishtar and Bel. So an incredible amount of money and time was wasted or spent building this structure. All because he wanted to unify the kingdom and have some sort of national religion and have power that way. So the tall was poorly designed, I would say, incredibly tall, very narrow, but I'm sure it won't have lasted. And the opening ceremony was held, an enormous band was collected, and whenever the band played, the herald stood up and announced that the king's command was that we should all bow down on the ground and worship the various gods portrayed on the statue. Now, this was a difficult position to be in. I thought, well, maybe I can get around this. Maybe I can just sort of reach down, you know, and maybe adjust my shoes. But I looked round, and my two friends, Han and Mish, they were standing straight up. And I thought, oh dear, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. I don't know what all the other people from my country were doing. They must have had a difficult decision. I think, in fact, most people there were sympathetic to us. They understood our difficulty, and they respected and liked us. But there just happened to be one astrologer who had it in for us. And he reported to the king, and the punishment that was announced was going to be death by furnace if you did not bow down. So we were brought before the king, and you can imagine the scene, the three of us there. So the king, furious, turns to us, each in turn, to ask us a question. What god do you think is going to rescue you from my hand now? What do you say, Shadrach? Shadrach, I should mention, is the Akkadian name for Hananiah. So Shadrach comes out with, we do not intend to defend ourselves and our actions. Very brave. The king looks at Mishael and says, what about you, Meshach? The God of heaven we serve is able to rescue us, your majesty. And then the king turned to me. And I thought, ooh, this calls for something brave to be said. And even if God does not save us, we will still not bow down to your statue. Possibly wasn't the best thing to say at that moment. The king was absolutely furious, and he ordered that the furnace should be heated up far, far hotter than it should have been. Very dangerous for the people doing the work. And yet a strange calmness and peace came over us as we saw that happening. We were going to our deaths, but we were going to our deaths in peace. Except that we didn't die. As we went through the door into that furnace, it was as if we went through another door into another dimension, into another kind of reality. And there we were met by a person. I don't know who he was. But it was perhaps one like Daniel had seen in his vision, one like a man and yet more than a man. One we had never met, and yet it was almost as if we had always known him. One who knew my name and each of our names, and yet whose name I do not know. It's impossible to describe what meeting him was like, but I pray that you may someday meet him and know him too. For years later, whenever I was in trouble, whenever I was in difficulty, I thought back to that day and what had happened and what had been said and what I experienced. I thought, into the furnace again. I could smile at danger as I thought of that encounter. Well, many, many years passed, More and more exiles came from our home city, our homeland. I served day by day the daily grind of work as a provincial governor. The king died and was succeeded by one or two rather indifferent kings who didn't last very long, and then by Nabonidus. Nabonidus was technically the last king of the Babylonians. However, another name you must know about is Belshazzar, because Nabonidus decided to rule his empire from the south, from Tima, a city in Arabia, and he left in charge his son Belshazzar. So he technically was the king of Babylon. Daniel only met Belshazzar once. The occasion was a feast. Belshazzar decided to invite 1,000 people to this feast. It was immense extravagance, needless extravagance, an attempt to impress people. He was an arrogant and narcissistic man. He brought out from the treasury the cups, the very cups and plates that I told you about that had been stolen by Nebuchadnezzar. And he used them, of all things, to ask for toasts to be drunk to the gods, various animistic gods, gods of silver, gold, wood, stone. And I had a bad feeling. I thought, this is terrible. This is not going to end well. Suddenly, in the middle of the feast, a hand appeared on the wall. The king turned, everybody turned and looked. People were shaking, people were dropping their goblets and spilling their wine. The king was terrified and asked, "What do the words that are written by the hand on the wall mean?" And nobody knew. The king knew nothing of Daniel. He had long since been forgotten and lived in obscurity for decades now. But the queen mother, an old lady, she happened to be there. And she said, "There is one person, Your Majesty, who could, I believe, tell you what these words mean." So Daniel came out of obscurity for this one day. For such a time as this day, Daniel had waited. And he faced the tyrant and he fearlessly told him what the words were. "Many, many, Tikal, Parsim, many. Your Majesty, you have been numbered. Your days are numbered. Weighed, you have been weighed and found to be wanting and to be too light. Parsim, your empire, your kingdom is being broken up and given to the Persians." And so that night died Belshazzar, and the kingdom fell to the Persians. There were many other things that happened, and time forbids me for telling you about them. Some of these things you will know, some amazing stories of Daniel. But in conclusion, I want to suggest a couple of things. Wherever God puts you, accept it. Don't fight against it. Become, wherever you are, a blessing to those who are in your immediate vicinity and around you. Be all you can be, a motto that even institutions like schools have taken for themselves. And trust him, for he controls the times of kings and emperors. He is in control. And lastly, fear only God. Fear him in the right sense of that word. Fear him instead of everything else and everyone else. Fear him and you will fear less. Fear him in your habits. Fear him with awe. Fear him in remembering that you're nothing without him. fear him by remembering the one who came to Daniel and waits to meet you someday. The one before the fearless Daniel was shaken and helpless and powerless. The one like a man who I met in the furnace. He is beyond my understanding, but he walked with me through the flames, and I put my life in his hands, and I'm honored to remain his humble and obedient servant.